Hi, this is Lindsay Dalen from Neal & Associates in Grand Prairie, and this is Benefits Genius podcast number 29.
Hey, it's Howard Kettner, and this is a podcast with a difference. For years, I'd been hearing about Dave Patriarch, the CGIB, and the Plan Administrator Checklist. Finally, because the Plan Administrator Checklist had been recommended to me by so many of the folks that I know and respect, I jumped on a plane, went to Toronto, and took it all in over the course of a morning event in which Dave presented his Plan Administrator Checklist and how to use it in a host of client and prospect situations in ways that establish you as the subject matter expert and in a way that builds trust with your audience. We're not going to get a full morning's worth of material into this podcast, but we're definitely going to keep it rolling. So stay tuned and stay focused. It's going to be a jam-packed hour.
Well, here we are, Dave, and I've been getting so many questions from Benefits Genius members and from folks on our mail list about the Plan Administrator Checklist. Folks just want to know more. And I know you've done some terrific presentations to the Benefits Genius community. You've done a ton of presentations to the CGIB community. And people just want to know more. Or is that just what I'm hearing?
No, it's funny. I did the seminar once or twice in Ontario, and I did it out on the East Coast and the West Coast a number of years ago. And everybody kept asking for me to come back and do it again. And every year I'd say, okay, I'm not going to do it because we just did it last year. And then I'll end up with 30 or 40 people that say, come on, please do it again. We missed it, or we have people like to send to it. Say, okay, we book a room for 30 or 40 people, and we have, you know, 50 or 60 or 70 show up. But I think you were at one of those where the room was packed, there's lineups for the washroom, and you just kind of go, how does this keep happening? But there's definitely a demand for people to get better, it seems.
Well, let's go back to the very beginning. Why did you put this list together?
Okay, if I'm really honest, it's because I couldn't remember all the stuff I wanted to do. So when I was newer to the business, I used to go into meetings, and every time I'd finish a meeting, whether it was a prospect or a renewal or whatever, I'd always come out, you know, wishing I'd asked a question or wishing I'd covered something that I forgot.
Don't we all?
Yeah, and nothing unusual there. And we've talked about in some of the podcasts about checklists and pilots using checklists and doctors using checklists during surgery and stuff like that. It was never that well thought out. It was just kind of a neat timing. I was in the business maybe 2 years, and Manulife did a great seminar where they brought together brokers from across Canada, mainly Southern Ontario, I think a big chunk of us, for a 2-day event that was educational, and they brought in all these experts. So there was accountants and lawyers and different people that were sales experts and stuff to talk about the technical and stuff around group insurance. And Barry Noble was the, I think, VP of small group locally. And so he kind of brought us together. And one of the speakers he brought out was Elizabeth Forrester, who recently retired, but used to be with Blaney McMurtry. And she went through this thing about what plan administrators need to know and don't always know, and some of the liabilities that went along with it. So out of that, as I was kind of writing a list, I went, okay, this is a checklist I want to make sure I kind of go through. And after she finished that evening, sitting down probably just after dinner, and Barry sat down with me for a second and took some time and said, if you can only do a few things in building your business, put your clients first, don't put them at risk, and make sure they're taken care of. And those kind of things just stuck in my head. And they sound really obvious, but they seem to be missed by most people in our business. And so I had the list in one hand, this conversation in the other, and kind of put it all together. And when it was finished, it was about a page and a half long. I sent it back to Elizabeth and said, would you vet this? And she said, you know, this is great. You shouldn't say this quite this way, and you should add a couple things that you've missed. And the list was born, and it's evolved ever since then. But that's kind of where it came from. It was just to try and avoid missing things at renewal. And it also ended up being a bit of a reducer in liability because I would have the client sign off saying that we'd gone through it all. So I didn't realize at the time how much that meant, but it meant they listened more and they were more serious about it and protected me as well.
Well, one of the things that I found so interesting as I participated in the plan administrator checklist event that you held, and you're right, the room was absolutely full and lineups for coffee and washrooms. But, you know, when I think about a plan administrator checklist, there's a ton of things that folks cover, starting with life insurance and going through disability and so on. But you kind of launched right into some of the taxation issues to consider. That fascinated me.
Over the years, the list changed in ways, but I always kind of thought, start with some of the stuff that they know and are maybe comfortable with. Again, I'm speaking to the client, so the plan administrator. So
absolutely. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, so kind of gets them on the same page, and you kind of go, you know, you should know. Well, you don't quite say it that way, but you should know that, you know, life insurance is a taxable benefit now. AD&D is as well, and how that cost sharing works. You know, so if you have the employees paying a portion, then you might want to have them paying the life insurance and the disability first for tax reasons and stuff like that. And as you start, they go, yep, I know that. I know that. And they feel pretty good about themselves, which is good. And if they've been taught well, some get stuck at those ones. And then you kind of start to roll through there, and you know, you get into disability, and they know if it's employer paid, then it's taxable time of claim. They know if it's employee paid, it's not taxable. But then what we'd say is, but did you realize there's a third way? If the employer pays it and it's shown as a regular taxable benefit, then it's tax free at time of claim. And, you know, can't be done retroactively and stuff, but, you know, here's a different way of doing disability that you may not have known about. So all of a sudden you start to take them into unfamiliar territory.
Well, and that little thing about cannot be done retroactively, I mean, that turns out to be a really big thing from what I'm hearing from your audience, because they're sitting there. And again, I love the way you do it, where the plan administrator is on side, they're nodding because a good plan administrator knows a lot of that. And then you get down to the, but did you know you can't just add it to the T4 at the end of the year?
Yeah. And lots of brokers say that you can. And they just go, oh, yeah, just, you know, you pay it all year, so it would look like a taxable benefit. Then at the end of the year, you just make it non-taxable, so you switch it. And the interpretation bulletin that says you can't do that. Like, it's very clear. You can't change the status after the year is over. You have to do it all the way through. So, yeah, so you're kind of shaking them away. And now you reference an interpretation bulletin, which are being phased out now. They're being replaced by folios at CRA. But that interpretation bulletin IT-428 now takes you to a referenceable document that they can go and review. So now it's not just my word of what's right. It's here's a CRA document that explains it. And that now sets you up as the beginning of a subject matter expert.
One of the things we talk a lot about at Benefits Genius is speaking the language of your audience. I mean, you dive right in as well to talking about deductions. I mean, you're talking to a payroll person. And so what a great way to bond with them by walking them through how they go about the deduction process and updating deductions.
Yeah, and this is kind of a neat one because very few people actually put much thought into it. If it's anything more complicated than just LTD. But sometimes people go, oh, yeah, I know what I'm doing. The plan administrator will say, you know, we pull off the premium for the LTD just like it's on the bill. And I will stop and go, okay, that's great. Okay, that's simple deductions. That's easy. But it's LTD plus retail sales tax. If you're in Ontario or Quebec or anywhere that charges retail sales tax, you have to include that as well. And that usually kind of stops as well. And many believe that, you know, you just update that once a year. And it's usually because that's been what's reinforced at renewal time. Here's your new rate. Oh, by the way, you have to update your LTD deductions. Well, no, it's not just then. It's when increases go up or down. It's when people get medical underwriting approved. It's when somebody changes hours or somebody changes class. There's lots of different times. And quite often the plan administrator is maybe aware of one or two, but don't even think of the other ones.
Exactly. And from there, so talking to the plan administrator about issues of taxation and deductions takes you very naturally to having a conversation about the CEO or the shareholders in the organization.
Yeah. You know, one of the big things I want to do is the old Hippocratic Oath for doctors is, you know, do no harm to your patient. And so I don't want us to create a plan or use a plan in such a way to put them at risk. So one of the things we talk about is how to avoid taxable shareholder benefits. So if a plan isn't administered improperly, then you can have situations where during a CRA audit, you could have an employer's expenses that they've been cost-plussing, for example, be deemed to be fully taxable, and you'd end up with a double taxation problem. So the case that everybody uses is Spicy Sports.
That always gets everyone's attention, doesn't it?
Well, it's amazing because it's 2004, so you know we're now 13 years later, and I'm still amazed by how many people aren't aware of the case because it is the defining case that went to the tax courts and was very public, and every accounting firm talked about it. But most employers don't know about it, and the reason is because most brokers don't know about it. And that's, to me, kind of shocking. But so, again, now we're bringing in a different level of, you know, kind of adding value as a broker to the conversation. Now we're not just referencing tax stuff like the interpretation bulletin. Now we're referencing legal cases, and it's not legal cases that are kind of ambiguous. Spicy Sports is a company in Whistler, the little ski rental place. So now it's something that's not an ambiguous thing. It's a small company that's being sued because of misuse of a benefit. So we now are kind of bringing the legal side in and showing that we know, you know, a little bit more than just benefits and tax rules.
Again, picking up on what you said about the Hippocratic Oath and do no harm, it's such a natural entry into the whole issue of mandatory and non-mandatory and why, which I think you do an amazing job of covering.
Yeah, it's one of my deal breakers with clients. You have to have a mandatory plan that is structured mandatory to protect you. And the question I always ask is your plan mandatory, or are you protecting the insurance company? Because if you have a non-mandatory plan, you're protecting the insurance company. If you have a mandatory plan, you're protecting you. By having 100% of your employees on the plan, you're reducing liability dramatically. You're improving your rates because you're sharing the risk in a larger pool and so on. And it's really important that that gets structured contractually, that it's mandatory to kind of avoid late applicant rules and stuff. So again, working on keeping the client safe and whole, because most of them don't realize that having a 75% participation plan actually can put them at millions of dollars of risk when it comes to, you know, a disability for somebody who isn't on the plan, but, you know, maybe should have been, or after the fact will regret it and wish they were.
Well, and speaking of inadvertent exposure to risk, you know, plan administrators that I've come across are generally very capable, competent people, but they really are depending on us to be the subject matter experts.
Yeah.
And you talk about the non-evidence maximums. And for those of us in the business, it's kind of like, well, yeah, people might be underinsured, but I'm not sure that's the first thing that every plan administrator would twig to.
No, and to take that one step further, it's not just, oh, sure, some people don't have full coverage. Who cares? They just don't want to pay more. It's not my problem, is kind of the way it comes back. And you kind of go, hold on, you have a responsibility as an employer to ensure that the people, your employees, get the benefits that they're eligible for. And the courts have found that over and over again. So if you have a $2,500 non-evidence limit and the person's eligible for $5,000 a month, they may get a request to fill out a health questionnaire for that extra $2,500 and not think anything about not doing it, just going, oh, well, you know, it's no big deal. I save $20 a month or something. But if they go off on disability, one of the first questions the lawyers will ask is, why don't you have full coverage? Why don't you have $5,000
a month? Sure.
And the person's going to say, well, you know, they sent me a form. Did they follow up on it? Did they do anything to ensure that you got the coverage that you're eligible for? Or, you know, are they just, you know, maybe trying to cheap out or too lazy to do the administration and kind of go from there? And I say to the employer, if you're not going to enforce people getting the full coverage they're entitled to, then just cap the plan at $2,500, cap it at the non-evidence maximum. And that way, everybody gets base coverage with no questions asked. You don't have to go around chasing people for forms. But when it comes to disability time, that person that, you know, should be getting $5,000 a month is only getting $2,500. There's no liability, because if you say the maximum is only going to be $2,500, then that's all a promise that you're making. But I have walked into cases, my favorite one, where the lowest income in the group was $100,000 a year. I asked the plan administrator and the head of the company what they thought they were going to be getting, and they said two-thirds. And they know it's a kind of a messy schedule, but it's two-thirds of their income up to $10,000 a month. So I said, okay, well, based on your incomes, what do you think that's going to be? And one said, oh, it's about $7,500. And the other said, oh, I'll get the $10,000 maximum. So I said, would it surprise you to find out that you're going to get $1,000 a month? And they just looked at me slack-jawed, and I said, you know, I've got a copy of your billing here, and each person is at the non-Evans maximum of $1,000. You've never filled out the forms. And they said, well, our booklet says it's two-thirds to $10,000. I go, yeah, but if you go back 20 pages, your booklet also says upon approval of medical evidence. Nobody's done that. Nobody has that coverage. And it was a total shock to them. They had no idea that had any of them been disabled, they would have had a severely restricted income.
So there you have it. That is such a great story and a great example of an inadvertent exposure to a liability. And benefit plans, you know, I just reviewing mentally here what we've covered in the last 10 minutes, there's a level of complexity that didn't exist a decade or two ago in many situations.
I'll challenge you a little bit on that one. I know we talk about that, like it's gotten more complicated. I don't know if it really has. But what has happened is employees have become much more litigious.
Definitely.
They make a phone call to the lawyer very quickly. The lawyers are now working on contingency fee, so there's no fee, so there's no barrier to access to those lawyers, and they're jumping at cases. And I think there's a lot of stuff where we're seeing, and this is not a bad thing, this is not slighting insurance companies, but there's areas where the insurance companies might have allowed a little flexibility before to their own expense.
Definitely.
Whereas now they're actually saying, no, we have a contract and you agree to the contract. We're going to live to the contract. We're not going to make exceptions every single day. Or if we made an exception once and it happens again, we're not going to make the exception a second time. And that's totally within their right. That is what the contract is all about. So I think it has changed a little bit, but I don't think it's that much more complicated. I think it's just more people are living to the contract, more people are going to lawyers and so on.
Really good point on that. We used to be able to call the head of the marketing department at the insurance company and say, you're going to have a really grumpy client here, so we need to fix this, and it wouldn't be fixed. And you're absolutely right. That's not happening now. And so where does that leave the plan administrator?
Well, so knowing that there's all these risks out here, there's this great thing that nobody knows about. And I don't know why this is to this day, because I think this should be group 101 and every insurance company should be teaching every broker when they start to deal with them. But this is a great thing called plan or benefit administrator liability coverage. And basically, it is a rider to people's business liability, their CGL policy, that covers the employer in the event of error or an omission in the administration of the plan. So very similar to us having E&O coverage, this is basically the E&O coverage for the employer, the plan administrator. So if they forget to enroll a new employee and then the person died, you know, 6 months later or was disabled and sued, then this is what would protect them. It's usually free of charge. That's the great part of it all. And a lot of companies have it built into their CGL policy already, but many of them, they have to go and request it. And usually it's free. If anything, it's a very, very small charge, but it's about the best, cheapest insurance you can ever buy.
Totally blew me away. After sitting in your event, I went home and checked my own coverage, and there it was, a page dedicated to covering me as the plan administrator for my plan or Coral or whoever's doing the administration. And so I'm talking with a CGIB member the following week, and they're telling me about bumping into a situation where the person, you know, reached for the file cabinet and pulled it open and took a look at the coverage and it wasn't there, talked to the broker for the CGL. And the broker said, well, that's going to cost you $2,000 a year. So your CGIB member just says, well, I think you need another broker. And there are a lot of them that will arrange this coverage as part of the overall package for nothing. So as this member related to me, talk about making me look like a hero in front of my audience. Instantly, there wasn't anything that could have established me as a subject matter authority more than referencing this item.
Well, you know what? And I will never put down another broker. You never know anybody else's world. You don't, like, I mean,
right.
I don't think you get ahead by pushing somebody else down. I think you actually get ahead helping other people up. But one thing I will say is if I say, tell me that you have this in place. If I walk into a prospect and it's a really messy case, tell me that at least your broker has shown you this. And I will tell you, every single time the answer is they've never heard of it before. And every time I'll say, then your broker knows nothing about employee benefits. I'm sorry, but like I've taught this to thousands of people across the country. It's been around for as long as group insurance plans have. And that will be the worst thing that I will say about a broker. They know nothing if they don't know about this. If they don't know about the, and I'm sorry, Howard, because there's lots of people out there listening that are going, I don't know what he's talking about. But bottom line is, if you have a get out of jail free card for your business and you're not giving it to your clients and it's free, then what are we doing? I don't know what else to say than that. Like, I mean, do no harm. And if we have a get out of jail free card, let's give it to every single client prospect that we can.
Absolutely. Well put. And that's a great analogy, your get out of jail free card. It's there. And my own little coverage policy for my tidy little organization provides $1 million of plan administrator coverage.
Mine does for CGIB as well.
It's crazy. So talk a little bit about medical underwriting and what you bumped into and why you have that as part of your checklist, your late applicant, late enrollment issues.
Yeah. So one, I structure plans mandatory, so we almost get rid of late applicants or late enrollments just by the contract itself.
Right.
But quite often I'll hear from other brokers, or even sometimes from my cases when the insurance companies make an error, is they'll say, okay, well, we have a late applicant. The right answer should be, okay, we're billing it back to the effective date. You know, somebody who maybe was married but hadn't updated it, or their common law and forgot to mention it the 1 year line. And so they'll say, we have two choices. We could either just enroll them today and medically underwrite them, or we're going to back bill for, you know, a month or 6 months or a year or whatever it is. And when the client hears that, they go, oh, well, we'll just let the person fill out a health evidence form because they're healthy. The problem is nobody, no broker, no client, no employee can say they're healthy. And the reason that is the insurance company decides who's healthy. They define what's acceptable risk or not acceptable risk. And I see this, and this is maybe when you're in the room too, this is always an arguing point with people where somebody says, well, you know, if the person's had cancer or a heart transplant and three heart attacks, you know, they're uninsurable. I know they're uninsurable. So I know they're not in good health. And I even say, you know, even on those ones, it doesn't hurt to have the person fill in the form, send it in, and be declined. Because in the off chance that the insurance company approved them, for whatever reason, maybe it was an error, they then have coverage. And why should we take away the opportunity for an insurance company to make a mistake? So we really want to avoid these late applicants. We want to avoid medical underwriting because no one knows who's in good health. That's kind of what it comes down to.
You know, that's a real voice of experience statement, Dave, and maybe it's a great opportunity to go down a little bit of a rabbit hole.
Sure.
This sounds like the voice of experience of someone who's sat in a witness stand or had a lot of conversations with lawyers about various benefit plan provisions, because anybody that's been through a discovery knows that those are the types of questions that get asked. Like, who are you to say that this person was in poor health or shouldn't be applying, right?
Yeah, and I've done a little bit of that. I've worked kind of behind the scenes and worked with lots of lawyers and expert witnesses in our industry and stuff like that, and I've acted as an expert witness myself. And when you're right, like discovery is boxes and boxes, you know, emails and everything you can think of. And those are the questions that get asked. It's just, you know, at what point did you do this? At what point did you do that? Why did you make that decision? Why didn't you go to the insurance company and have them make the decision? Why did you stop that process? Why did you, like, and you sit there and go, the things that we kind of take for granted sometimes all get totally dissected. And, and it's, nobody wants to be there. The question I get asked quite often is, I must have been sued a lot of times to come up with this list and try to avoid this liability. And I go, no, I've never been sued. I hope I never am. Real life, I probably will be at some point. And I'm hoping that this list and all the other things I do will protect me. But, you know, the whole reason for the list is to avoid a lawsuit. You don't want to go through this. Whether you win or lose, the process itself is extremely draining. Me just acting as an expert witness on a court case is, you know, a huge amount of time. And I have a, you know, a relatively small role compared to the brokers, the insurers, the, you know, advisors, the plan administrators, whoever's involved. It's something you want to avoid.
Absolutely. And you know, in terms of avoiding sticky situations, we see some of the simplest things tripping us up or tripping a plan administrator up, like earnings is earnings, isn't it? I mean, isn't that pretty simple, Dave?
That one actually comes up more often than you think. The definition in the booklets and in the contract will say earnings are salary plus commission plus bonus plus regular overtime, you know, something like that. And then what the employer is reporting is only the salary. And they don't think about it. They think of earnings as salary when earnings is actually defined as something different. And so when you come to a disability, and I've had this happen with my cases and others, you know, somebody goes off on disability and they're expecting, you know, $5,000 a month in replacement income, and they find out that they're only going to get $3,000 because the other $2,000 was on commission, but it had been misstated. And those create liabilities that can't be fixed. I mean, if they sue for the difference, they'll win every single time. You have a contract that you as plan administrator did not administer correctly. And so you want to make sure all that is kind of done well. And I had a case years ago, a prospect that was referred to me, and they had had a bunch of employees that were working 25 hours a week, and their eligibility was 24 hours. So these people were on the plan. They had life and disability, health and dental. And due to a growth in the business demand, everybody went up to 40 hours a week. But they never updated the number of hours. The hourly rate was the same, but their hours were higher. So now the annual income was up, and the employer forgot to tell the insurer. So when one of these people went off on disability, they ended up at an income replacement of 25 hours times their amount instead of 40. So, you know, all of a sudden they got 25 40ths of what they thought they were going to get or were entitled to. And that was a huge problem. So getting the right information there, keeping it updated is really important.
You know, as I sat through your plan administrator checklist event for the first time, it's so interesting, you know, just thinking about my own thinking as I went through it and realized as you were peeling back the layers of the onion that really many of the assumptions that a layperson would make about a benefits plan would be what would get them into trouble. And I'm always thinking about travel coverage, like I've got out of country as part of my health, right?
Yeah, and that's a changing thing. So that is one area that's changed dramatically. In about 2011, the insurance companies started putting in pre-existing condition clauses, and there was roughly defined ones in the past, but they were not clear. They weren't defined in employee booklets. They weren't on the websites. So the insurance companies tend to pay a lot more claims than they needed to because the lawsuits would have been to the benefit of the employee who was had a travel claim. But since then, most of the companies have put in, you know, pre-existing condition clauses. They make sure that you're medically stable, that if you don't contact them right away, they don't have to pay claims. There's a lot of nuances to it. And this is no different than individual travel coverage, where most people think they buy a policy from the travel agent or the bank or online and they're covered, and they don't pay attention to pre-existing conditions like the group plans, but also things like hazardous sports and, you know, the drinking clause. If you're under the influence of alcohol, most of the policies don't, you know, cover you on an individual basis. Group plans do presently. But they find out, you know, shockingly at the time of claim that, you know, all of a sudden it isn't what they thought it was.
As we think about the world of the plan administrator, I mean, my sense is that one of the things that your checklist does is it brings a lot of comfort to them that they're dotting the I's and crossing the T's. I mean, as you think about the myriad of administrative issues that somebody needs to deal with, and for many of our clients, you know, in a group under 200 employees, under 100, under 50, I mean, plan administration is really being done off the corner of someone's desk.
Yeah, it's not a full-time job. There's not somebody dedicated to it. It's something that in some of the small cases, you know, under the under 10 life groups, they might not have an enrollment for years. So, you know, every time they do it, it's a brand new thing. So we kind of cover a lot of administration stuff, everything from making sure the changes and enrollments are done in a timely manner. And what I say to my clients is, if you're not sure, call me. Call me before you do the offer letter. Call me before you send in the enrollment form. If you want help, you know, going through it all, or you have questions, just let me know. Administrative-wise, we want to make sure that terminations are done, and we want to make sure that, you know, anything that they're putting in writing, maybe in an offer letter or a termination letter, is covered. And we'll just kind of go through a longer list. I'll go through a bunch of them. Just, you know, are they updating salaries all, you know, not just at renewal time, not just once a year, but when there's changes? Are they making sure that everybody's getting their full benefits that they're entitled to? And are those changes that you're going through with employees, are they actually making it through on the billing? So if the person sends in a paper change form and it gets lost in the mail with a salary update, well, they should be checking the billings to make sure that it's there. Better yet, they can do it online, and they can see right away that the system's been updated or not, which is obviously a much better way of doing it. And some silly administrative stuff as we kind of continue through, are they keeping copies of the forms? Some of the insurance companies require the plan administrator to hold the originals. Others, the insurer is. But, you know, you maybe are doing an enrollment form today, and that employee 10 years from now passes away, and they're going to ask for that form to know who the beneficiary is. Do you have it? You want to make sure that they keep copies of all that kind of stuff. And some of the silly things administrative-wise is, are you paying your bill on time? It's one of those things that nobody thinks of as being...
I love how you frame that part of it, though.
Yeah.
You know, paying your bill on time means that you're not becoming the insurer.
Exactly. And so if you are doing deductions from employees for, say, long-term disability, or maybe you're doing a 50-50 premium share, and you're collecting it, but you're not remitting it to the insurance company, then you are the insurance company. You've given the employees a promise to pay. That's the employee booklet, the contract, the insurance policy you bought. But if you're in claim suspension because you didn't pay the premium, but you've still collected it from the employees because it comes out automatically off their pay, then you're putting yourself in a risk. And with small companies, when cash flow is tight and there's a fluidity to their bank account, then that can be a real problem. And so we want to make sure that they realize if your claims go into suspension, there's no claims paid. And what that means is there's no disability claims paid and there's no travel claims paid. If somebody's out of country and they have an accident and they call in, there's no coverage. And it's up to the insurance company, believe it or not, whether they want to reinstate your policy, because the contract says once you've gone 30 days without paying, the policy is terminated. Now, real life, most insurance companies will allow it to go 45 or 60 days, some cases longer. But contractually, if you now looked at a situation where they had not paid for a month or a month and a half, and now there's a disability case that's massive, their opportunity to walk away from it is there. Would they do it? I would hope they wouldn't. But hey, if the client hasn't paid the bill contractually, they can walk away from it. And from a financial standpoint, that would be the smartest thing they could do. So I make the employers very aware of the risk of not paying the bill.
And what a great opportunity to establish ourselves as the subject matter expert. I remember one of my very first clients when I came into the business, and folks that have been to our events know that the bulk of my clients, as I was getting going, came out of the forest industry. And there was a downturn in the forest industry. One of these clients went into receivership and started dragging all of their payables, 60, 90, 120 days. Well, the receiver came in from one of the top three accounting firms in the country, and they were not aware that they were actually becoming the insurer as a result of dragging the invoice for 60 or 90 days. And confirming that, number one, speeded up the payment, but number two, established me as a credible subject matter expert. And that's what folks are relying on us for. We're not always the bearer of good news, but again, it's that do no harm that you referenced throughout your presentation.
Totally.
Now, where does government insurance fit into all of this in the dialogue with the plan administrator?
Well, and it's interesting. So most of the plans are coordinated with provincial plan coverage. So in Ontario, we have OHIP, and BC, you have BCHIP. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah, medical services plan. Yeah,
medical services plan.
Yeah.
So the assumption is that, you know, when somebody goes in the hospital, that the ward coverage will be paid by the provincial coverage, and the group insurance will pay on top of that. Likewise with things like travel coverage. So they have to know that everybody has to have their provincial plan coverage. And if they don't, if it's a foreign worker on work permit, if it's maybe a Canadian who's left the country and come back and so on, they've got to make sure that they get coverage to be entitled to their group plan. And that can be a huge issue if it's not in place. So we're not having everybody chase everybody down for cards necessarily, but we do, you know, make them aware. So if they make an unusual hire from a foreign country or something, that they want to kind of keep that stuff in mind.
And as soon as we raise the subject of government insurance, that takes us right full circle back into disability and WSIB, WCB obligations.
Yeah, and you know, that this comes in, you know, the whole disability side comes in, and we kind of talk a little bit about that. Just many people think that if you have a workers' comp claim, or in Ontario it's called WSIB, that you know, you don't have to worry about LTD because the government's paid for it. Well, that's not the case. The government may be paying for it, but we still have to let the insurance company know because it is a disability, so that has to happen at exactly the same time. In most cases, if it's a righteous WSIB claim or workers' comp claim, then the province will pay for it. But if it was overturned or if it was deemed to be not a workplace injury, then it becomes an LTD claim. So we want to make sure that that's done kind of right up front. And just overall on disability, we want people to make us, the broker, aware, make the insurance company aware very early so we can start that whole process working. So if it's a workers' comp claim, we can tell them to fill out the LTD claim forms. If it's just a regular LTD claim, if there is such a thing as a regular one, then, you know, 5 to 6 weeks from the last day worked, we want those forms all sent in and stuff. And we want to kind of make sure that that process runs as smoothly as possible, because that's, in my mind, when the employees need us more than anything else.
You know, as I see it, what you're doing is you're raising the profile of the benefits plan and putting it on the agenda in terms of what an organization considers and needs to think about as other changes are happening. You know, you think of mergers or acquisitions or closing of a division. Benefits is like maybe number 29 on the list of things that that CEO or that plan administrator is thinking about, because again, they're not doing necessarily plan administration. They're doing an evaluation of this new entity that they're bringing in.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So I've been involved in now a lot of those. So if you're bringing in a new entity, you're buying a company, you want to know kind of what's the promise that's been made to those people? What's their benefit
right.
plan like? Do they have one? Are there things like open LTD cases? You know, what baggage are you bringing along with the purchase? And likewise, when you're kind of selling off or closing things, you know, what do you have to deal with to kind of deal with those issues? And we want to kind of know those just from is the staff increasing, decreasing? How's this going to work on the next renewal and so on? And administratively, just, you know, if you're merging two companies, what's the new company name? Do we have to change employee booklets? Do we have to change the contract? Because the contract is a legal binding document with the old owner, but if the new company is the merged name or something, then we have to change that type of stuff as well. Those ones are kind of the simple ones that people may think about, the lawyers may bring up as they bring them together. And then there's kind of a whole level behind that of, you know, maybe the other plan is not mandatory. Maybe they have
right.
people off the plan. Maybe they have part-time and seasonal and contract and union and, you know, all sorts of different structures that you don't have that you now have to kind of make allowances for or adjustments for when these mergers happen. And is it really a merger? Are you buying a company or are you just hiring the employees away? So one thing that just came up recently we were talking about was if you bought the company and you're bringing the employees over onto your plan, the buying company's plan, you know, are you going to the insurance company and saying, hey, we're not just enrolling employees. These are not just new hires. They're company employees for 20 years. We want to waive the pre-existing condition clause and bring them into the plan with no waiting period effective this date of the merger so that there's no reset on the pre-existing condition clause for disability, for example. We want to bring them in whole and keep them whole. And majority of brokers totally forget about that. They just say, just treat them as new enrollment, have everybody fill out a form, send them in, and away you go. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just they get treated as a brand new applicant. So the pre-ex gets reset on LTD, for example, is probably the biggest risk. And we want to avoid that if we can avoid that.
So what I'm hearing you say is that there's a bunch of HR-related issues that get kind of bundled into the things that a plan administrator and an advisor need to be thinking about. Because again, we're bringing in this other entity. We want everybody to have this great feel good about joining us or whatever. But as we go through other HR issues, I mean, there's a host of things there that plan administration needs to be paying attention to.
Yeah, and I'm going to go through a whole bunch of them kind of fast, but you're right. Everything from, you know, when somebody leaves a company and they do a blanket termination letter or a formatted or templated termination letter, you want to get information about conversion of the life insurance and health and dental and disability if it's available. So, you know, here's your final pay, here's your record of employment, you know, please return all company property, and oh, you have the ability to convert your life insurance and LTD maybe and health and so on. So it's right in there. We'll kind of talk to plan administrators about offer letters, making sure there's good information in them, like, you know, benefits are mandatory and cost sharing is mandatory. We don't put in dollar amounts, but we just say, you know, that's important to get in there so they know. And we also want to say maybe that the employee is responsible for keeping the employer up to date on changes that affect benefits. So if they get married, it's the employee's responsibility to tell the employer that they've done that. We want to avoid bad offer letters where people say, hey, you get full benefits on hire, and the definition of full benefits is, you know, not understood. And, you know, we want to kind of avoid them putting themselves at risk. And part of this is helping them write HR policies, and I'm not an HR consultant by any stretch, but we want them to kind of think about at least some of their corporate policies. So do they have a policy on contract staff or independent contractors? That can be right. A real issue. I spend a lot of time talking about that, trying to keep contract staff off plans because they're not permanent full-time employees. And we want to make sure that that's really all that's on the plan to minimize liability and having those people defined as employees. And we'll talk about policies about discontinuation of benefits or even discontinuation of employment after a long absence. If somebody's away for, you know, 2 years, then a policy can be written to say after an absence of 2 years, your benefits will terminate. And that protects the employer from, you know, extended leaves and so on. It doesn't overrule legislation or anything, but if somebody's been gone for a long, long time and no longer of benefit to the company, then frustration of contract should be considered, and that person may be terminated or at least benefits discontinued to protect the company. Those kind of policies, most companies are not great at writing, and they should really have some legal help or an HR consultant help them do it all.
And I've come across public sector employers where there is no consistent policy, period. Forget about a badly worded one. It's kind of like, well, we really like the head of this department, and so we're going to continue benefits for 3 years in the event of a disability, and maybe longer if we still like them.
When you go to court, you say, okay, what's the policy, and have you kept to the policy? And if you haven't, the highest standard is what would apply. So if you said, oh, we kept one person on for life, then the assumption would be then you keep this person on for life as well. You know, so whatever the policy is, you have to live to that policy. And if you want it to be something different, you have to amend it.
Well, and we see it pop up all the time in coverage extensions as well.
Yeah, people will put in a termination letter saying you've got benefits for the next 2 years when the insurance company has to be consulted and they have to approve the extension. What happens is when an employee is no longer an active employee, then they're not eligible for benefits, period. Contractually, they're done. So what we're doing is going to the insurance company and saying, we have a severance situation where we're going to extend benefits or we're going to request to extend benefits for a year because of the severance package we're going to offer. Would you be willing to extra contractually provide coverage for this employee, even though they're not actively at work with us, for that 1 year period? And the insurance companies quite often will do so as long as it's reasonable with the length of time they'd work there and position and so on. But, you know, quite often people will put stuff in writing that the insurance company will not do, and that just puts the employer at risk right away. So, again, I will never hold myself as a lawyer. I'll point people to lawyers and HR consultants and so on all the time. But I'll definitely say, look, this is something you got to know about, and I can kind of guide you. But at the end of the day, I don't know all the parameters. You want to sit down with whoever you're dealing with, your labor lawyer, employment lawyer, when you actually get to this step.
This, again, we've been kind of framing this on an assumption that the audience is my existing client. But how else do people use the list, and what does it look like at a desktop level? So I have the list, I've bought into everything you've been covering, Dave, now what?
Well, and so the first part of that is exactly what you just said. You bought into everything. Your list that you're going to create, Howard, or any broker listening, is going to be all the stuff that they buy into. So the list may be half a page long, not a page and a half. And half these items may not be on it. If you don't buy into it, don't put it in front of your client. But you're right. It was originated as an existing client retention training kind of tool. But mm-hmm. over the years, it's changed. So it's now a great closing and sales tool. I've walked into cases where people have asked me to go in and talk to the plan administrator, executive director, general manager, or owner of the company, just to help them with their plan because they've had some problems. And the first thing I do is just say, okay, listen, forget the booklets, forget the plan design, forget all the stuff. Just let's just talk a little bit about plan administration. We're going to just kind of do all this, and your broker probably goes through this with you, and you probably have a checklist, which most of the time they'll say no. And once you start to go through the list, you find out very quickly most brokers don't cover this stuff. And it's
right.
These are the same plan administrators, whether it's my plan administrator, yours, or any other brokers. They all have access to the same information. They're all administering essentially the same plan. So the education that they get should be similar, you would think. Like, I mean, if you think about any other practice, I mean, you know, we all drive cars we don't all, but a lot of us drive cars. And you think the training that most people get is pretty similar. Whether you went through driver's ed or whether you had a parent teach you or a friend, you kind of go through a lot of the stuff, whether it's the rules of the road, legislation, whether it's the taxation part of it, how you pay your licensing for the car and your plates and your license and stuff, how you actually drive, your daily administration, how you check the oil and all that kind of stuff. We're all taught that stuff in a common form, even if it's from different people. In benefits, that doesn't seem to be the case. It's kind of like you threw the keys to the plan administrator and said, okay, go drive it and good luck. And you walk away. And if that is the case, then, you know, the broker's putting their E&O online as well. So when you're going and using it as a sales tool, you're differentiating yourself from, I can guarantee you, every broker that's ever been in there.
My favorite word, differentiation, you know, advisors coast to coast, struggling to differentiate and often turning themselves inside out to find a product with a small little differentiating clause or coverage, and meanwhile missing the point that we are the best differentiation that prospect will ever see.
Yeah, and it's easy stuff. You don't have to go out and find a contract and the one and only company that does something. You don't have to go out of your way to add an extra, you know, employee assistance program value add that you're going to bundle in. It's all the stuff that they should know that you should be sharing with them that's free. Like, I mean, this is basically an hour investment in your client that will differentiate you from anybody in the world. It sounds, you know, like this wonderful promise, but it is. Like, it's not being done by anybody. So, again, and with my theme of I don't, you know, put other brokers down, I just say, you know, I'm sure that if you have a benefits-focused broker, they're going through something very similar to this with you and covering all these areas that we're going to cover in the next hour. And they look at me and go, I've never heard anything like this ever before. And so all I say is, well, you've probably just never dealt with a benefit-focused broker before. I do nothing
right.
But employee benefits. And so that just, you know, sets you a little bit apart from there. And then we talk about, you know, once you have the client at renewal time, it's just a great reinforcement tool. So, I mean, that's where it originated. Just kind of helping them remember all the stuff that we talked about when it was pre-sale, at sale, and then we reinforce that at renewal time. We do that every year. Most of the time, I got to admit, we don't go through it with every client all the time at every renewal. After you do this for about 10 years, the clients actually can recite the list back to me. So they'll say, you know, what's new on the list? Or, you know, let's just do a quick review and I'll go, yep, 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 no. And every now and then we'll have somebody say, oh, geez, you know, that's a good point. I'd never used to deal with commissions until this year. Let's talk about what that means. And it'll help draw some of the things out from there. So the whole idea of the list was not to be the be-all, end-all. It wasn't to answer and address every single plan administration thing. It was to start a dialogue to bring out the other things that aren't being talked about and to kind of just reinforce the things that we think are probably most important.
And I love the reinforcement process. And you talk about it, about how particularly in the early going, you'll often obtain a sign-off from the client acknowledging that you've reviewed the information and that they understand it, which is one of those rules of public speaking, right? Tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. And so now they have this piece of paper saying, I've gone through this process. I mean, you talk about helping your audience to be a better version of themselves. I mean, don't think that they're not going to mention it to their coworkers, to their boss, to their subordinates, whatever, that
they
completed
the secret
process.
Yeah, they keep it because they want to sound like a superstar and just dribble stuff out all the time. But no, but you're right. And I think the sign-off itself, when they actually are said, okay, we've reviewed this and I understand it, it means they're signing saying, hey, I'm taking some responsibility for everything we just talked about. And there's a lot. It's information overload. So this is so important. This broker sitting in front of me is making me sign off on this. If I don't know it well enough now, which quite often they will sign it even if they don't, then you can pretty much sure they're going to review it once you leave. And what you'll find quite often is you'll get a call the next day from somebody saying, you know what, I went through that whole list with you and that's great. I really appreciate it. But there's a couple things I want to go over again because I don't understand it. And that to me is fantastic. So you know they've taken the time to go back to it. Not all the time, but every now and then it happens, and that's great. Those are the ones that are the great plan administrators.
Absolutely. Well, this has been fabulous, Dave, taking the time to go through this as part of a podcast. Anything else you want to add, just kind of wrapping it up?
I would say, and I say this before every seminar, the list has to be what you're comfortable with as a broker. Even if people kind of look at what we just talked about as being this big, long list and a lot involved and everything, if you just start with four or six things that you think are important that you want to talk about, then start with that and just work it into your conversations, work it into sales, work it into renewals, and just grow it over time. You don't have to start with the finished product. You can start with something that's really short and sweet. I think that's the one thing that kind of brokers, you know, find this all too daunting a challenge and go, well, geez, I'm never going to have a list like Dave, so what's the point of even trying? And that's the wrong answer. The right answer is just pick the things you're comfortable with, the things you like to talk about, the things you want to make sure they understand, and start with a short list. And you can go back and be a hero over and over again every year when you add a few more things to your list and integrate it into your renewal package. And what you'll find is as that list grows, it'll become one of your biggest sales tools. And for the most part, when I walk in now to a prospective client, we push aside the books, we push aside, you know, that plan design and the billings and the copies of the census and the 3 years of claims experience, we push it all aside and we talk about this. And when we talk about this and we have a conversation after the list about, is your plan mandatory? Now that you know how important it is, we're going to have to make a change. So your list maybe just went from 50 employees to now it's going to have 75 on it. Right. And the billing that you have that's has all out of date salaries, now you know how important it is to have that up to date. And all of a sudden, we're not shopping the market, we're fixing the case in the current place. So there's so much that kind of flows out of this when this is your starting point.
Well, to our audience, I would just say that this podcast has been worth thousands and thousands and tens of thousands, and it just continues to amaze me, Dave, and I hope I never ever take for granted the wisdom and the knowledge that you share out so freely. I mean, you've just shared your best ideas in terms of client retention and prospect attraction, and I think it's just so amazing, and Dave, I just can't thank you enough. But just know that this is really appreciated. I know I'm going to get a flood of emails after we post this podcast. And huge thanks again, Dave.
No problem. Thank you for having me. I'm sure we'll end up doing more of these seminars down the road again. So being, you know, a lot more detailed and going through examples of every step all the way through it. But obviously, we don't have 3 or 4 or 5 hours to do a podcast. So thank you for having me as part of it. I appreciate it.
A real pleasure. Thanks, Dave.